if you could just introduce yourself to us for those that might be unfamiliar with who you are.
All right. My name is Hans von Sponeck. I was the United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator until March 2000, responsible for the Oil for Food program in Iraq, where I stayed for 17 months in charge of that program. Prior to that, I held various responsibilities within the UN. I served 32 years in the United Nations, and senior posts in the UN included the posts of UN representative in Pakistan and in India, and the director of the UNDP office in Geneva.
And originally, when you took the post in Iraq, what had been your expectations of what the situation was there?
Well, when I arrived in November, with me arrived a crisis. So I, right up front, became very quickly aware of the complexity of a program. I expected to face a complex situation as far as managing an oil for food program is concerned. After all, it was the program, today I call it the moral fig leaf of the United Nations, the humanitarian exemption to protect people against the major impact of economic sanctions. So I knew it would be a very difficult program. What I didn't realize is that it was a program that was wrought with many, many obstacles posed to a lesser extent, viewers may be surprised to hear that, by the government of Iraq, and to a much larger degree by the UN Security Council, and here in particular by the British and American governments, who didn't want that program to run smoothly.
And were you surprised to find out that it was the American and the UK governments that were causing the problems here?
I was surprised that they were willing to put obstacles into the way, even though it involved the welfare of innocent people. That surprised me very genuinely. And all the efforts on the ground in Baghdad, we were over 800 international staff responsible for this Oil for Food program, to try and demonstrate the negative effects of what now is widely accepted as a failed policy of economic sanctions, didn't translate at the New York end. It was business as usual, and it became more and more refined over the years, but not with the effect of making a substantial difference for the Iraqi people. It just made it appear more acceptable in the public that didn't know the intricacies of managing a sanction program.
And you finally quit your job in protest of the situation there?
Well, when you see that you are associated with the wrong policy, a policy that at best halts the deterioration of the lives of people, at worst continues to be responsible for the death, particularly of the young, the babies and the children, then it's a question of conscience. And I couldn't be associated with that, recognizing that I was part of a faulty policy. To continue would have made me a co-accused, and I could not accept that.
What were the conditions when you left your position there?
Well, the situation for the general population had become increasingly desperate, despite the fact that there was more oil money, not because the UN allowed more oil, but because the world market price for oil, including Iraqi oil, had improved. So the conditions in purely material, physical terms, was a bit better. But after, at the time when I was there, 9 years, now over 12 years of sanctions, the situation is pretty hopeless. And the reports of the United Nations and of other reputable international organizations like CARE International or Caritas or Save the Children UK demonstrate very clearly what the international community has done and what the international community ultimately will be accused of having done, and that is to contribute to such unbelievable suffering as the Iraqi people have to incur. So it's not a situation we can be proud of now, and later on when the facts, long after Iraq hopefully has returned back to a normal life, when the facts become known, I think many faces, if they have any conscience, will blush.
Now, you recently returned to Iraq, is that correct?
Since my resignation in March of 2000, I've been back 5 times. So I try regularly to go back with the help of church organizations, with the help of television companies, with the help of individuals, certainly not, as I've been accused of, with the help of the Iraqi government. I wouldn't do that. I've been back in order to make sure that I have an up-to-date knowledge of the conditions in Iraq.
And what are the conditions now? Have things gotten worse?
It can't get much worse. People have become so impoverished that an improvement in the availability of medicines or a slight enlargement in the caloric value of the food basket fundamentally don't change the picture. I think there's only one thing that can change the picture, and that is lifting of economic sanctions, giving people a chance to vie for their own livelihood. That will make a difference. So when you travel now to Iraq, and this time I was in southern Iraq, I was in Baghdad, I was in the Kurdish areas, so I have a fair sense of the situation, and street picture looks a little bit more normal, but when you penetrate into the situation a little more deeply by talking to people, by going to their homes at random, nobody stopped me, and I did go into homes to see for myself how conditions were in these houses, or I think the word house is in some cases not even a justified term. These were miserable facilities where people had some kind of a roof over their head. Then you begin to realize it can't get much worse. And the other side, of course, that is of increasing media interest in particularly the United States is the question, how much of a threat is Iraq? And what I saw on this visit was something truly remarkable. With me was the German television. The official German television accompanied me on this entire visit, and I requested the government of Iraq to allow me to visit sites which U.S. intelligence and mainstream U.S. media, like the Washington Post and the New York Times, had identified as having resumed the production of chemical and biological agents. And I chose sites that had been identified in such a way, and what I saw was a picture where you don't need to be a disarmament expert to know that these facilities cannot possibly be a threat to anybody because they're destroyed. I saw a foot and mouth disease vaccine producing facility that I had visited already in 1999 when I was still in office. And it was destroyed then, disabled by the UN arms inspectors, disarmament specialists. And now in 2002, the facility was in the same destroyed condition in which I had seen it before. And the same applied to a facility which is in the western desert, west of Baghdad, where at one point Iraq tried to produce chemical agents out of waste products of the castor bean, which is used to make brake fluid. And the facility, that is the equipment that was used to do that, had been disabled, and I saw this facility in a totally disabled condition. There was no sign of a production of any kind. It was rusting away. Now, I think this makes me a person who can give more evidence about Iraq's threat than the U.S. Secretary of Defense, who keeps arguing that Iraq, every day that Iraq continues, is a day that Iraq is more dangerous. Well, he lacks the evidence. He doesn't show the evidence to the public, and I think, therefore, his statement is out of order. I'm not saying that I can vouch now that Iraq isn't a threat, but if I choose at random two sites which are mentioned by intelligence as posing a threat, and they are not, then I have a pretty strong case in suggesting that it may very well be worth it to have a dialogue with the United Nations, invite the arms inspectors back, which Iraq is prepared to do, but only with guarantees that the United Nations will not yet again be misused for intelligence operations as in the past.
Talk about that a little further. In the U.S. media, they make it seem that Saddam Hussein is being totally unreasonable with his allowing UN inspectors in. What's the truth to that?
Yeah, well, I think it is correct to say that Saddam Hussein has for a long time objected to the return of arms inspectors. He thought he would get away with that. And he cannot get away with that. The world is entitled to know that he is no longer a threat, as he seems to argue. So it's a question of pressing ahead with that demand. And of course, with the very imminent and real danger that the U.S. may decide, unwisely decide, to go ahead and mount a war against Iraq, he has become more forthcoming in saying, yes, the inspectors can come back, but not unconditionally. And I understand that. Whatever one may think about a dictator like Saddam Hussein, I do understand why there is that demand for guarantees that the United Nations is not once again being misused for spying activities. I think it was one of the great harm that was done by the CIA and by the American government, by the British government, by other governments maybe, but certainly by those two, to clandestinely infiltrate the UN disarmament group with people who did not have in their mind the disarmament of Iraq, but rather to find out intelligence information that was passed on totally against what the United Nations stands for. So that they want to avoid this, that they're arguing now in the recent talks with the Secretary General in Vienna in early July, the Foreign Minister of Iraq, Naji Sabri, made it very clear that yes, they can come back, but they want to make sure that there is that the UN can guarantee that it will be a time-limited inspection to verify that Iraq has not once again been dishonest, but that indeed Iraq has nothing to hide nowadays.
One of the other justifications the U.S. media is claiming is that Saddam Hussein has been diverting funds from the Oil for Food program towards programs like weapons production. Can you address that at all?
Yeah, I would say in the Iraq discussion, nothing is black and white. Everything is gray. But I'm amazed what one can read in U.S. media in terms of statements from officials or from journalists that portray in Iraq and make statements that are totally invented. Saddam Hussein cannot possibly get one single U.S. dollar out of Oil for Food program funds to be misused for anything but what it is meant for, and that is for the Oil for Food program, because he doesn't see the cash. The money that Iraq earns from oil extraction goes straight into a United Nations administered oil account with the Banque Nationale de Paris, The United Nations manages this account. The United Nations pays for contracts that Iraq enters into directly to the supplier, and the items are then coming under United Nations control into Iraq, and a large team, over 300 UN observers, guarantees that these items go and verifies that these items go where they're supposed to go. So if anyone argues that this money can be misused, either it's malicious, because then the party who argues that knows better, or it is total ignorance. What is more correct is to point the finger at the illegally acquired oil revenue from the export of oil over and above the oil that is channeled through the official accounts of the United Nations. There it is correct that Saddam Hussein is earning anywhere between $1 billion to $3 billion. The highest figure I've seen in the press refers to $3 billion US dollars as extra income from illegally exported oil. Now, there we see some misuse. If you call the construction of palaces, it's again vastly exaggerated. There are some palaces that are being constructed, but at a scale that is quite different from what we are made to believe in the media. Or that there are luxury goods acquired, yes, that is also true. But these are relatively small amounts. Why do I say that? Because one of the great weaknesses of the United Nations sanction regime is that it does not allocate a single dollar for overhead financing. Every country, small or big, needs money to pay its teachers, to pay its civil servants, to pay for the upkeep of the physical infrastructure, hospital, bridges, roads, and so on. A good amount of the money that he's acquiring, if you want, illegally. It's, after all, it is Iraqi oil that is being illegally or extra legally brought to Syria or to Turkey or into the Gulf somewhere. If you look at that, then you can only conclude, if you are fair in your assessment, that a major part of that money is required to finance the running of the country. So it's another smokescreen here.
So as we speak, the U.S. is just a matter of a couple months away from what appears to be attacking Iraq for a second time. Can you comment on that?
I hope that ultimately there will be a sufficient buildup of pressure on the U.S. administration in Washington to reconsider that plan to attack Iraq. The evidence that Iraq is an imminent threat, which would give the president the authority to carry out, without congressional approval, some argue, a preemptive strike, isn't there. And this time around, it's not going to be a 30-plus country coalition that will support an American, I call it aggression, against another country. It is a very lonely affair. And I would hurry to say here, it's lonely not just because the Middle East isn't with the U.S. and Europe isn't with the U.S., but also because there is an increasing number of Americans that are against such a venture, such an adventure, as the German Chancellor has called it, and saying that he is not about to participate in such an adventure. But I think it's very important, particularly internationally, to point out that there are plenty of American groups and individuals who are very, very concerned over the warmongering that comes out of Washington. And as a European, as a non-American, I would just like to say it is in a way frightening to see this disconnect between the American public or large segments of the American public and political decision making in Washington.
It appears that both, even the military in both Washington and the United Kingdom, are opposed to the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
That is, I think, very correct. When President Bush was in Germany on a state visit, it became public for the first time that the U.S. military was highly concerned about the seriousness of purpose with which the Bush administration was talking about the possibility of a war against Iraq. They, of course, saw it maybe more from a perspective of, are we prepared to mount another war, to have a second war theater apart from Afghanistan and other smaller areas where there is a U.S. military involvement. But it was interesting that it was also a concern of a political nature. So suddenly the U.S. military behaved more responsibly as politicians than those whose job it is to be very careful before they take such a dramatic step. The British military, we hear isolated voices, but we hear them loud and clear. A former field marshal just recently talked about the insanity of a war against Iraq. There are 150 members of the House of Commons, some of whom have a military background, who are cautioning the Blair government to go along with the U.S. So there is no shortage of resistance, of objection from all quarters, whether from academia or from the political side or from the military side. And important, I think, in a democracy, also from the public conscience.
So how do we break through to the American public conscience when it appears that the administration and our U.S. media are walking step in step together on this?
Well, what can you do? You can only do the utmost in creating awareness of the real conditions, encouraging Americans to go to Iraq and see for themselves, and then become focal points for awareness creation within their communities. And it was to me always very impressive to see that the largest number of visitors I had in my office during the term I was in office in Iraq were Americans. So there is a large pool of knowledgeable American citizens who I think now, I remember here a word of Dr. Martin Luther King when he said, there comes a time when silence is betrayal. This time is now. I think this statement of the 60s is very relevant this century in 2002.
What are other important facts or concepts about this do you feel are not being covered in the media that you would like to communicate to people?
What I feel very severely missing is that in discussing now, for example, last week in the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the threat, it was almost as if one just wanted to put a Senate approval stamp on something which had already been determined elsewhere. And I think there needs to be a much greater public debate, and individual citizens must challenge the Rumsfelds and Wolfowitzes and Richard Perls of this world to come forward and demonstrate why there is such an immense threat, which no one else recognizes as such, that would warrant even a discussion of a war against Iraq. That's one point. The other point is, I see hardly any reference in the discussion, either in the U.S. Senate or in the State Department, let alone in the Department of Defense, that reminds Americans that the United States is a member country of the United Nations, a body that the U.S. has been instrumental in 1945 to create. And if the U.S. administration wants to act in accordance with international law, then it better remind itself that there is something called a United Nations Security Council that would have to vet a decision to go to war. And the awareness, of course, is, I'm sure, in Washington, that the United Nations Security Council would never give such a stamp of approval. Maybe that's the reason why they don't wish to associate themselves too closely with the world body that was created to solve conflicts peacefully, to convert swords into plowshares, and not the other way around, as Washington seems to be determined to do.
Yeah, it seems that the whichever U.S. administration is in power, that if they know ahead of time they can get the U.N. blessing, they are very supportive and talk very highly of the U.N., and when they know that the U.N. is going against them, they seem to pull back almost and totally disregard the U.N.'s position.
Yeah, the sometimes when political figures make statements, they forget that the world has a much better conscience than they may, a conscience and memory than they expect. I don't think the world has forgotten the words of Jesse Helms of 3 years ago when he visited the Security Council and said, if what you're doing is in our interest, we strengthen you, and if you do the opposite, we will marginalize you. Now, that's the kind of unilateralism, that's the arrogance of power, which will have a high price, which is not in the interest of the United States to pay such a high price. And in my travels across the U.S., I've come across a very large number of people who share that perception. So the U.S. government should think twice before it is willing to embark on an adventure that carries a very high price, not only in terms of lives lost in Iraq, if there is a war against Iraq, but also a high price in terms of lives lost in the United States. Young men and women who have a right to live a peaceful life will be endangered and may never come home alive. And I think that should also figure in the decision-making that is right now underway in Washington. And Mr. Rumsfeld in particular, who has been so cold-blooded in his determination to move ahead and fulfilling what in a newspaper a few days ago was headlined as Rumsfeld's dream, and that is to get rid of a regime that nobody likes. But there are ways, there are options for getting rid of regimes or for containing regimes, and the one he has chosen is acceptable to no one, and if he has any conscience, it should also not be acceptable to him.
If you were in the working in the U.S. administration, what would be your solution to dealing with Iraq?
I would try to remember 1945 and the promises that the U.S. government made in concert with the other 51 member governments that existed in the United Nations at that time, and that is never again let us try to solve conflicts, global conflicts, in a peaceful way. Now, that's not a naive statement. That is simply saying there is a body that should be used up to the last moment to prevent a military confrontation. And right now what we see is a determination to bypass the United Nations altogether and just go it alone, whether the world likes it or not. I would try very hard to encourage myself and others around me to return to a more sane approach in dealing with conflicts rather than the one that has been chosen right now.